You're listening to a sermon by Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, August 17, 2014, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
As Dennis said, there are 11 Elijah stories in all, and we heard three of them this morning. And they're bizarre stories. Stories which seem to have been floating around as oral tradition for quite a while, and almost, you know, aspects of them enter into the legend category. They're so fantastic, so fanciful. But there's a reason these stories are told. Because, as in mythology even, and I'm not claiming this is mythology, Elijah's no god, religions generally have stories that are passed on because the stories make some points in ways that just making the point doesn't quite work. And so I'm going to be looking at the passage in the bulletin in this respect. Any one of you who have sung or heard sung Mendelssohn's Elijah, the powerful oratorio, has enjoyed the drama of today's Old Testament story, the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And to hear a choir of 150, "Baal, we cry to thee, Baal, we cry to thee," you actually almost feel sorry for them when they lose. It's so, the music is so wonderfully great. But the story is quite remarkable because there's a defiance not only of Baal and the 450 prophets, but also there's Elijah's defiance of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. If you know of any friends who are having children, the names Ahab and Jezebel are generally available. Elijah's actions openly opposed federal law, and opposed his nation's absolutist rulers. This northern kingdom of Israel was no democracy. There was no fair judicial system. This was a dictatorship with enforcers. After Elijah's prayers were answered in the story we heard, answered by fire from heaven, which consumed not only the animals being sacrificed, but also the water-soaked wood, and if the story is to be believed, even the stones and the dust and the water itself. And then after the slaughter of all the prophets of Baal, it seemed that Elijah's triumph was total. But was it? The story takes an abrupt turn. When Jezebel heard what happened, Elijah was suddenly forced to flee for his life. He became a fugitive. Now, after all that demonstration of his faith in God, where was his God? Elijah's flight eventually lasted 40 days, a symbolic number, especially when done in a wilderness. He was exhausted physically, mentally, emotionally. Worse still, he was experiencing a faith crisis. He wanted to die. Elijah went to Mount Horeb, called the Mountain of God. Mount Sinai is also called Mount Horeb in Hebrew scriptures. So Elijah, who had hoped to renew the covenant between Israel and God, went back to the place where Israel had received the law from God. In verse 9, at that place he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he answered, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. The Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left. And they are seeking my life to take it away." I do not see in this story Elijah acting impulsively. I see him being analytical, being a careful observer of national politics and religion, culture, someone who thought things through. And reading between the story's lines, I can imagine that Elijah thought about his situation for each of the 40 days he was on the run, hiding from Ahab. I can imagine him going over and over the events, what had been said, who had done what, the victory, and then how it all went wrong, looking at things from every possible angle. So, after those 40 days, when God asked Elijah, "What are you doing?" Elijah was prepared. He summed up the situation for God in 3 points. "I have been zealous for the Lord." In other words, "I'm a true believer." "The Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets. They're trying to eradicate you as a god, as a religion, and this nation." 3, "I am left alone. I'm all you got. And now they're seeking my life to take it away." This analysis could hardly be more depressing. So God tried to help Elijah see things differently. God put on a little demonstration to show what real power was like. There was a great wind, followed by an almighty earthquake, followed by raging fire, things insurance companies refer to as acts of God. And then came absolute silence, not words, but utter silence. And according to the story, that's when Elijah experienced God. And after a time of profound silence, God repeated his initial question, "What are you doing here?" And now we have the most amazing thing. Even after directly experiencing God's awesome power and sensing God's presence in the utter silence, Elijah was unable to see things differently. He was incapable of changing his analysis of the situation. He was unable to foresee how his role with God's power could change things. Elijah gave the identical answer word for word. He had thought about things so much he had convinced himself that was the way things were. Nothing could change his view. And so in verse 15, God responded, and the response is absolutely stunning. "The Lord said to him, 'Go, return on your way to Damascus. And when you arrive, I want you to anoint 3 people. You shall anoint Hazael, king of Aram.'" Now that's a neighboring kingdom. Sometimes they had peace treaties with Israel, sometimes they were sworn enemies. But it shows God is going to be in charge of international relations, that maybe new leadership will change things. "Second, you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel." So Ahab and his dynasty will be replaced. If we have new leadership, maybe we can have new ways of doing things and get rid of the Baal worship. And finally, and this is the kicker, "you shall anoint Elisha, prophet, in your place." In other words, if the triumphant Elijah is incapable of changing with the times, incapable of changing his thinking when challenged by God himself, then it's time for something from someone else of the next generation to take over. It's time for a new approach. And then God adds, as a slap in the face, verse 18. And I would say we have to hear this both in the past and in the future tense. "Yet I have and will leave 7,000 in Israel," another symbolic number of completion, "all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, every mouth that has not kissed him. This is in direct reply to Elijah's analysis, which said, I'm the only one left. Elijah's analysis seemed wrong. It was even time to get a new prophet. Aren't you glad you came this morning? Some reflections. Elijah thought it was his business to save the world. He therefore analyzed things and gave it his very best shot. I, too, have my way of thinking about things. Perhaps you have, too. I've sometimes felt so responsible that I thought I had to do all I could to save this or to ensure certain decisions were made in a certain way so that things would work out the way my analysis said that they just had to. But what if my analysis is wrong? What would it take to get me to change my analysis? A windstorm? How do we know when it's time to change our way of thinking or when it's time to set aside because we can't see that we're actually unable to change our ways of thinking? How do we know when it's time for institutions to change? Maybe not entire kingdoms like Aram or Israel, but time for the church to change or whatever, time to move in new directions. How do we know when it's time to be silent or when it's time to anoint the next generation, time to lend them support, total support, while they try their ideas? A second area of thought raised by this story. Does God come to us today? If so, how? Disasters? Hardly. Nature? Maybe. Through the creative process of art or enjoying art? While working in gardens? Through utter silence? Do we have to be in a wilderness for 40 days before this can happen? The story has God experienced during utter silence. I experience very few times of utter silence. Let me rephrase that. I'm married. I don't experience any times of utter silence. Thanks to my internet radio, all hitched up, which has dozens of classical stations for choral music, organ music, all kinds of music from all over the world. Thanks to, well, English soccer season has begun, so God's not going to reach me Saturday mornings, unless he takes out an ad. Thanks to my smartphone, which has 10 e-books, I'm listening to 2 audiobooks and blogs I have to follow, and news items and newspapers. Anytime I encounter stillness, I ensure there is not utter silence. Even when it is utterly quiet around me and my smartphone's charge is depleted, the internet is down and the TV doesn't work, my mind is still experiencing storms as my thoughts fly about frantically, as they surely did for Elijah. What is utter silence? How might I prepare for it to be of use to me, to be of use to God? Someone has said that silence is not stillness. Stillness seems to be a precondition for meeting God. But silence is when we set our agendas aside, when we stop talking to God, and just listen. But what if, when we do all of this, we are only met with more silence? Remember the words of Psalm 46, some of which we heard this morning. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam and mountains tremble with its tumult, come, behold the works of the Lord. He makes wars cease to the end of the world. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear, burns the shield with fire. The Lord says, be still and know that I am God.